Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Politics podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Bill Scher. Today we are joined by longtime investigative journalist, Northwest correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and author of the new book, Alt America, David Nywort. Thanks for being on the show.
Always good to be here, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So this is a book that traces the history of the alt-right movement. But you have been on the beat of far-right extremism for a long time. Tell us a bit more about your background and what led you to write this book.
Well, my first newspaper job was in the Idaho Panhandle back in the late 70s, and that was just about the same time that we had the Aryan Nations folks moving in to that same neck of the woods, just 20 miles south of the town where I was working. And so I had pretty early exposure to them. And they always kind of lurked in the background of the work I did as a daily news reporter at various newspapers around the Northwest, because, it was a pretty steady stream of criminality that they and violence that they brought to the region. And so, you know, it was always part of my reportage. And then in the 90s, I started writing about these militias that were organizing in the back in the backwoods up here. And after Oklahoma City, I wound up sort of being a so-called militia expert because I was one of the only guys who'd actually gone out and talked to these guys. Anyway, I wound up having a lot of that work to do over the years. I was originally an environmental reporter, but one thing led to another, and I came to the realization, you know, in the late 90s that, you know, the radical right was a beat all unto itself that needed to be covered. And so I've just kind of stayed on it all these years as a freelance journalist. And I started up a blog that basically specialized in that sort of thing.
So when the alt-right was coming together in 2016, when Steve Bannon, who was leading Breitbart News at the time, talked about Breitbart being the place for the alt-right, were you surprised by that? Was it part and parcel of what you've been covering all this time, or was it truly its own independent thing?
Oh, no, the alt-right really is just sort of the latest permutation of the radical right. And in fact, alt-America really is sort of a 30-year history of how we got here. It dates the origins of this movement to the 90s and the militia movement. But it also, it is unique in its own way, particularly in the way it leverages technology and the way that it gears its appeals to young people and uses social media. Those are very new things and part of it. And so, you know, it's very much a mix of old and new. And let's be clear too, a lot of what I write about isn't necessarily the alt-right. When I write about the Malheur standoff and the Clive and Bundy element, the folks in the Patriot Militia movement, who, believe me, are very much still active out there in rural America. We're not really talking about the alt-right. That's not the alt-right. That's the Patriot Militia movement. They're kind of distinct. And
so what is the difference there?
Well, they have a coalescence of interests that are manifested in Donald Trump. But Trump really just kind of rose to the moment and took advantage of these things that were already very much in motion and had been in motion for a long time.
It can be hard to grasp how is it that these fringe movements have been around for such a long time, but have mainly been on the fringe. How is it that a Donald Trump could leverage them to win the presidency? Usually these are groups that Republicans are trying to show distance from. What is it about the current incarnation of the far right fringe that was able to actually help directly put someone into the White House?
Well, that has to do with what happened in the preceding 8 years. During those 8 years, what had been on the fringe was very gradually, but unquestionably mainstreamed by the mainstream conservative movement, by people in the mainstream conservative movement, and particularly by media folks such as Fox News. Glenn Beck was running these conspiracy theories back in 2009 and 2010. And what we particularly saw was that the Tea Party movement became a major conduit for the revival of the Patriot Militia mentality. Remember, the fuel that underlies all of this, Bill, is the conspiracism, is these conspiracy theories and the Alex Joneses of the world. And Jones had been around since the 90s. There was definitely a big gap between the conspiracy theorists and mainstream conservatism all during the Bush years, mainly because their primary conspiracy theory was, the 9/11 truth theories. And that was what they were all about during the first decade of the new century. And clearly mainstream Republicans wanted nothing to do with this because the object of that, the ultimate nefarious conspirator in the theories was George W. Bush. So it wasn't until Barack Obama was elected that we saw suddenly that gap just close altogether, that instead of maintaining their distance from conspiracy theorists, a lot of conservatives are actually openly embracing them. And we certainly saw that, in the form of Glenn Beck, the birther conspiracy theories, all of these various conspiracy theories that started bubbling up as soon as Barack Obama was elected. And it just got worse and worse with every passing year, to the point that it really, by the time, Trump came along in 2011 and really rode to political prominence on the back of the birther theories. And he maintained that for the following 4 or 5 years.
So are you arguing that, the lion's share of the Trump coalition are these conspiracy theorists, or are they a smaller piece that gives a certain energy and enthusiasm, bringing people in off the political sidelines who otherwise don't show up to vote?
Oh, I would say it's actually the lion's share. I think when we look at the polling of you look at the polling of Republicans and particularly Trump voters, the vast majority of them believe that Barack Obama was a Muslim. They believe that his birth certificate was fake. They believe that Democrats and George Soros are participating in a conspiracy to undermine Western white civilization. This is nothing new. I mean, the polls show that clearly a large majority of those voters very much are part of that world.
Now, we happen to be recording the day after Roseanne Barr's show was canceled after her tweets about Valerie Jarrett. and most have focused on the racist overtones to those tweets, but they also are speaking about a conspiracy theory involving Valerie Jarrett that probably most Americans don't even know what she's talking about. But when you saw it, did it you know, ring a bell with you about what she was talking about?
Oh, sure. Yeah, actually, I follow Roseanne partly because she is a very prominent spreader, very prominent node for the spread of these conspiracy theories. In particular, she's been really writing on this QAnon conspiracy theories. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but this was sort of the latest permutation in the Alex Jones world of these theories, these conspiracies that they believe are revolving around Trump and the Mueller investigation and Russia. It's a really convoluted theory, but basically they believe that, you know, in the end, Trump is actually going to, and Mueller, in fact, are going to turn around and arrest Obama and Clinton, not Donald Trump. That's what the Q theory is about. And Roseanne was one of the main people participating in this, you know, as a major node in Twitter for the spread of these theories. And so she's been doing this stuff for years. She's been dabbling in conspiracy theories. And some of them are really profoundly anti-Semitic, including the George Soros conspiracy theory that she was dabbling in just the very same day that she was tweeting out stuff about Valerie Jarrett.
Well, what is the when you look back at the 30 years of this, as you do in your book Alt America, anti-Semitism seems to be a constant thread, and I'm personally a little befuddled by that. You could maybe see how people might have, there might be a racist backlash after having an African American president for 8 years, but why is anti-Semitism a constant? Why do almost all conspiracy theories seem to, you know, lead back to that at some point?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the origin of the whole conspiracy theory world, which, you know, goes back to the 1920s when Henry Ford published The International Jew, which was a packaging, basically an English packaging of the Protocols of the Seven Elders of Zion, which was then, in fact, picked up by Adolf Hitler, you know, and widely spread by Hitler in the 20s. Ford did later in the late 1930s apologize for publishing this text, but it's never gone away. And honestly, Protocols of the Seven Elders of Zion probably is one of the very earliest conspiracy theories. Although I found when I was actually researching the Japanese American internment that these theories preceded even the anti-Semitic theories. There are theories that the Yellow Peril theory that was aimed at preventing Japanese immigration was, you know, basically a big conspiracy theory as well. So they've been around, but the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories have always been the very sort of meat and bones of the conspiracism world. And a lot of that has to do with the sort of shape of them. You have to have, in order for conspiracy theories to work, you actually have to have a target group such as Jews that a lot of people don't necessarily have a lot of contact with. And it becomes very easy to make them scapegoats in these theories, as well as, you know, make them out to be nefarious actors in an evil plot. And that really is kind of the bottom line of it. But the point of conspiracism has always been to undermine democracy. I mean, that's a lot of these, the original conspiracy theories were, you know, date back to the Illuminati conspiracy theories that were raised in the 1800s in Europe. were actually attempts by the monarchists to keep people who were attracted to the Reformation and the Enlightenment from gaining actual influence. And it has to do with basically it's all about the people who already have control and power use conspiracism as a means of separating people from the democratic values that might actually otherwise give them the power that they would have to overtake these sort of oligarchic influences. So that really is the bottom line. I mean, think about how conspiracy theories work, Bill. You have people who believe them because A, it feels initially empowering. You feel like you've got secret knowledge that nobody else has, and that you can see beyond the veil. And, you know, it has a very empowering feeling to it. That's a lot of their appeal. But further along you go into the world of conspiracism, the overarching narrative that you absorb is this sense that the average individual is actually up against forces so deep and entrenched and nefarious that they have no chance of overcoming them. So you're ultimately where that narrative arc takes you is to, you know, living in a cabin in the woods with a cache of beans and rice in a bomb shelter, because and totally disengaging from your democracy, believing that your vote is a joke, that democracy itself is a joke. And that is what the narrative of conspiracism really is about. It's about persuading people to give up on their democracy.
So as you've been tracking these groups more recently, now you have the conspiracy theory movement electing someone who traveled in conspiracy theories himself, you know, starting with the birther conspiracy in the White House. I mean, that's unusual for conspiracy theorists to see them electing one of their own to a place of power. How has that altered their view of the world?
Well, it's actually rather funny because now, of course, all of the conspiracies are, I mean, in some ways it hasn't changed it a lot because they see Trump as being up against these forces of globalism that they're always going on and on about. They see, and any criticism of him and anything that, you know, not just criticism, but any scandal into which he falls is, in their view, something just generated on behalf of these evil globalists. And so, you know, it puts them in an opposition because, yeah, they've always opposed the government, but now they've kind of shifted things now that they've got one of their own in government to now they're attacking the deep state. And so that's why you hear Sean Hannity and all these guys yammering on endlessly about the deep state, because that's the sort of node of the globalist conspiracy now that their own man is actually running the government.
Now, in your book, and we're talking to David Nywot, author of Alt America, which was published by Verso. As much as looking at far-right extremism or any sort of extremism, there's a certain there's a comical nature to it at times, but it gets very serious when you talk about acts of domestic terrorism. Can you explain the history of far-right domestic terrorism in recent years and why is it that that threat has not been taken as seriously as international terrorism?
Sure. Well, I actually started writing a lot about domestic terrorism in the 1990s, mainly because of Oklahoma City and Eric Rudolph and the spate of domestic terrorism that we had then. And as the next century moved in, and, you know, during the Bush years, the Patriot movement definitely went into decline. as did the domestic terrorism that accompanies it. However, by late in Bush's tenure, we started seeing a return of these militias, and we also started seeing very much an increase in the domestic terrorism, so much to the point that beginning in 2008, I created a database that we ran for eventually published at Reveal News just last summer of domestic terrorism. And I started keeping track of all the cases. The really kind of signal case was in June of 2008 when a man named Jim David Adkison walked into a Unitarian church in Knoxville, Tennessee, and began gunning people down. He was tackled by some of the churchgoers and wound up standing trial, and he's in prison for life now. But out in his car, he'd written a manifesto that was all about how he had come to just deeply hate liberals. And it was very clear that he had mostly come to deeply hate liberals by consuming Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, and various right-wing media. And he had come to the conclusion that the only way to deal with them is to start killing them. And his manifesto urged people to do that. Ever since then, we have seen just a real steady stream of major increase in right-wing domestic terrorism. Basically, between 2008 and 2016, those 9 years, that 9 year span, inclusive of both years, we saw about 116 cases of right-wing domestic terrorism in this country. A lot of them were related to the sovereign citizen movement. Sovereign citizen movement is so radical right that they don't believe that that federal authorities have any authority at all, and that even your local police are part of the Jewish conspiracy. So they frequently engage in shootings of local policemen. It's pretty ironic that there have been many more people killed at the hands of white sovereign citizens than have ever been even attacked by folks in Black Lives Matter. But you'll hear, for some reason, yet we have this perception that Black Lives Matter is a threat to our cops. And in fact, it's not that true. It's simply not true at all, that the threat to our cops actually comes from white right-wing domestic terrorists. And in those same 9 years, Bill, we saw about 60 cases of Islamist terrorism. So there were more than nearly double the cases of right-wing domestic terrorists that there were of supposed Islamists engaged. And the levels of violence were remarkably different, partly because almost all of the Islamist cases involved preemptive arrests. Because we devoted, after 9/11, we devoted all these resources to catching Islamists, and the resources devoted to focusing on right-wing extremists simply went away. The department, the section within the Department of Homeland Security devoted to focusing on right-wing extremists was shrunk from over something like 15 people to one. Yet we were devoting all, at the same time, literally hundreds of people were engaged in counterterrorism, dealing with the supposed Islamist threat. So, a lot of this had to do with the way it was being reported in the media. The media simply don't pay attention when it's a white guy who does terrorism. I mean, think of how reluctant people were to call Dylann Roof a domestic terrorist. And yet he clearly fit every criteria that you would have for a domestic terrorist. He wrote a manifesto. He had fully terroristic intent. He wanted to start a race war, and he killed people, you know, killed innocent people. So, I mean, it's not much, there isn't much more you need to describe a domestic terrorist if you understand what the definition of terrorism is.
Do we have a hard time? I mean, people sometimes point out, you know, we don't call white domestic terrorists for perhaps for racial reasons. Is it also possible that they don't have a singular group that they're a part of? You know, there's no swearing allegiance to ISIS. If there was a group, there was like one group they're all a part of, then maybe you'd think of it as a terrorist entity. But since this is happening in more of a loose, decentralized way, we don't think of it that way.
Well, that's true, except, of course, one of the major movements involved in this is sovereign citizen movement. And FEI actually does identify sovereign citizens as a domestic terrorist movement. To some extent that's true. The real problem is the law, the way the laws are written. As with hate crimes, terrorism is a matter of sort of definition, but it also, prosecutors are reluctant to prosecute people for any of the laws that might actually call them terrorist, because it requires another level of evidence, and it makes their prosecution much more difficult. So usually they will prosecute people for the underlying crime, because that's what they will be putting them away under. You know, that's what offers them the chance to put these people in prison. So And it's also very clear that we have these laws that are actually written specifically to take on Islamist terrorists and designate their work, what they do, as a form of terrorism. And they aren't applied uniformly across the board. It is actually harder to charge a white person with domestic terrorism in this country than it is someone who has an Arabic background.
Now, you have spoken to members of various far-right groups over the course of your reporting, and that's shown in the book. Can you tell us about some of the people you've talked to, and what have you gotten from them that you might not otherwise pick up through other reporting? And why do you think it is that they wanted to talk to you and are willing to share with them, you know, the details of their beliefs?
Well, they actually, I mean, a lot of this has to do with, a lot of times they'll talk to journalists because they think they could convert you. So, you know, I prefer to just kind of let the people speak and use what they say. I think what my book does more than anything is it provides really a broad and deep context for what is happening now. A lot of the events that I describe are actually things that people will go, oh, I remember that happening, but they didn't put it in the larger context of how this, the sort of trends that we saw coalescing under Trump. So, to some extent, mostly trying to give people the sort of informational context for understanding how we got here. But it's also, I'm also framing things in a way that gives people the context to understand that, you know, what Trump is doing is fundamentally promoting right-wing authoritarianism. And that is a trend that goes back a long ways in this country. In fact, it's always been latent in the American personality. And what Trump has done, I think more than anything, has been to tap into that latent strain and expand on it. I think it's not a healthy threat at all. So it's obviously very divisive.
Are there limits to how much he can do that? Because we still have a constitution, we still have a diffuse power structure with checks and balances. We still have midterm elections where possibly the pendulum can swing the other way. So it, do you have a, is there a sense that this is the high watermark of how far right conspiracy theorists can get, or do you have more of a darker, you know, can it happen here? Can fascism happen here? Yes, it can. And we're watching it happen right now.
Sure. Well, I mean, I of course, I didn't think he would actually win the election either, but I really believe, you know, American voters are smarter than this. And I think, you know, we'll see in the next two elections. I believe in my heart of hearts that, yeah, people are going to rise up and come out to the polls and vote in large numbers, both this year and in 2020, and sort of overturn this verdict and this trend. They could prove me wrong. The thing that bothers me is and worries me is that the checks and balances are clearly not going to work, because those checks and balances included having a Congress that was willing to stand up to an authoritarian president, as well as a Supreme Court that would do so. That's what our checks and balances are. And right now, we don't have a Congress that will do it, and I don't think we have a court that will either.
Circling back a bit to Roseanne Barr, she is not someone who was seen as a conservative until more recently, and even some conservatives will still say she's a far left liberal, not a far right conservative. In your research, how much does the far left extreme and the far right extreme do come together? I mean, there have been cases of far left domestic terrorism. There's been the Unabomber. There was the congressional shooter who was a Bernie Sanders supporter. Is this something that is just a facet of the far right, or do you see it on both sides?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's particularly when you get to the very, very radical far left, the you know, the folks in Occupy. I've certainly seen a huge amount of bleed over from people who were involved in Occupy who later became hardcore Trumpers, in part because they hated Hillary Clinton with such a white hot passion, but also I think because that they were inclined to this populist outlook in the first place, as well as the conspiracism. I mean, and this is a trend that I certainly saw going back in the 90s. There are a lot of people on the very far left who've always been prone to conspiracism as well. You know, the contrails conspiracy, or the chemtrails conspiracy theories, the various health conspiracy theories. And, you know, and I used to go to these hippie barter fairs here in the Northwest in the 90s and encounter these conspiracy theorists working with folks on the far left, you know, UFO theories. David Icke's is probably the most prominent one, the guy who believes that our leaders are actually alien lizard people from another galaxy. You know, and this stuff's been floating around for years. So there definitely is a tendency towards it. And ultimately, it does come down to authoritarian personalities. There are right-wing authoritarian personalities. There are also left-wing authoritarian personalities. And authoritarian personalities aren't the people who want to rise up and be the authoritarian leader. They're the ones who want an authoritarian in power running things. And that's what authoritarianism really is all about. It's not we always think of authoritarianism in terms of the person on top, but the genuine phenomenon of authoritarianism is actually all done happening on the ground. And it's all about the people who buy into the need for an authoritarian leader, and, or in the case of left-wing authoritarians, they sort of substitute the strongman type with rather the utopian state that they wish to achieve, although they also often believe, really frequently believe, that utopian state can best be achieved under the leadership of a singular authoritarian figure. So they often come to resemble each other in a lot of ways, but ultimately, authoritarianism is fueled by fear. It's all about fear. You know, when people are in a fearful and chaotic state where they can't ascertain what's true and what's not, the default response is to resort to authoritarianism, because it at least offers a prospect of some semblance of stability and security, which is really what people want.
Now, this is always the unfair question. What should people do? What can, knowing all this information, people who are concerned about the power of conspiracy theorism in our politics, what can people do to try to quell it?
Well, of course, it's very hard. Once people go down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole, it's almost impossible to pull them out. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of love. And it's really, really hard, because they're really immune to logic and facts and reason. The only thing that they're actually not immune to is emotional appeals and personal narratives. And it's a lot of work. But really simply put, I mean, the flip side is that actually the short-term answer right now is, it's really very simple. Vote. Get everybody you know out to vote. Get everybody off their butts and get them into the voting booths. Because this is a profoundly anti-democratic movement. It's about undermining democracy. It's about putting democracy in the hands of oligarchs, or putting our society in the hands of oligarchs, and actually ceding our own political power that is embodied in the vote to other people. So, that's the bottom line. And the only thing ultimately that these guys actually understand is raw political power. So if you beat them about the heads and necks at the polls, eventually a lot of this stuff loses its teeth. And people who are then in the very engaged in the hard work of pulling their friends and loved ones out of the conspiracist rabbit hole actually have a much better chance at succeeding. As long as these guys are in power, it's really hard, because these guys, you know, conspiracists have to do is, you know, look up to the top of the heap right now and say, hey, stuff's working. It's all true, you know? And so, the answer in a lot of ways, at least for us right now, is pretty simple. Just get people out to the polls, as many as you can. Get everybody out to vote. It's about saving democracy. It's about reviving democracy.
The book is Alt America: The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, published by Verso. David Nywaert, thanks for being on New Books in Politics.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bill. I really appreciate it.